The Man Who Plowed the Sea, first published in Satellite, June 1957, collected in Tales from the White Heart. This story was written in Miami in 1954. Despite the lapse of time, many of the themes of this story are surprisingly up to date, and a few years ago I was amazed to read a description in a scientific journal of a shipborne device to extract uranium from seawater. I sent a copy of the story to the inventors and apologized for invalidating their patent.
The adventures of Harry Purvis have a kind of mad logic that makes them convincing by their very improbability. As his complicated but neatly dovetailed stories emerge, one becomes lost in a sort of baffled wonder. Surely, you say to yourself, no one would have the nerve to make that up. Such absurdities only occur in real life, not in fiction. And so criticism is disarmed, or at any rate discomfited, until Drew shouts, "Time, gentlemen, please!" and throws us all out into the cold, hard world. Consider, for example, the unlikely chain of events which involved Harry in the following adventure. If he'd wanted to invent the whole thing, surely he could have managed it a lot more simply. There was not the slightest need, from an artistic point of view, to have started at Boston to make an appointment off the coast of Florida. Harry seems to have spent a good deal of time in the United States, and to have quite as many friends there as he has in England. Sometimes he brings them to the White Hart, and sometimes they leave again under their own power. Often, however, they succumb to the illusion that beer, which is tepid, is also innocuous. I'm being unjust to Drew. His beer is not tepid. And if you insist, he will give you, for no extra charge, a piece of ice, every bit as large as a postage stamp. This particular saga of Harry's began, as I've indicated, at Boston, Massachusetts. He was staying as a house guest of a successful New England lawyer when one morning his host said, in the casual way Americans have, "Let's go down to my place in Florida. I want to get some sun." "Fine," said Harry, who had never been to Florida. 30 minutes later, to his considerable surprise, he found himself moving south in a red Jaguar saloon at a formidable speed. The drive in itself was an epic worthy of a complete story. From Boston to Miami is a little matter of 1,568 miles, a figure which, according to Harry, is now engraved on his heart. They covered the distance in 30 hours, frequently to the sound of ever-receding police sirens as frustrated squad cars dwindled astern. From time to time, considerations of tactics involved them in evasive maneuvers, and they had to shoot off into secondary roads. The Jaguar's radio tuned in to all the police frequencies, so they always had plenty of warning if an interception was being arranged. Once or twice, they just managed to reach a state line in time, and Harry couldn't help wondering what his host's clients would have thought had they known the strength of the psychological urge which was obviously getting him away from them. He also wondered if he was going to see anything of Florida at all, or whether they would continue at this velocity down US 1 until they shot into the ocean at Key West. They finally came to a halt, 60 miles south of Miami, down on the Keys, that long, thin line of islands hooked onto the lower end of Florida. The Jaguar angled suddenly off the road and weaved away through a rough track cut in the mangroves. The road ended in a wide clearing at the edge of the sea, complete with dock, 35-foot cabin cruiser, swimming pool, a modern ranch-type house. It was quite a nice little hideaway, and Harry estimated that it must have cost the best part of $100,000. He didn't see much of the place until the next day, as he collapsed straight into bed. After what seemed far too short a time, he was awakened by a sound like a boiler factory in action. He showered and dressed in slow motion, and was reasonably back to normal by the time he had left his room. There seemed to be no one in the house, so he went outside to explore. By this time, he'd learned not to be surprised at anything, so he barely raised his eyebrows when he found his host working down at the dock, straightening out the rudder on a tiny and obviously homemade submarine. The little craft was about 20 feet long, had a conning tower with large observation windows and bore the name Pompano stenciled on her prow. After some reflection, Harry decided that there was nothing really very unusual about all this. About 5 million visitors came to Florida every year, most of them determined to get on or into the sea. His host happened to be one of those fortunate enough to indulge in his hobby in a big way. Harry looked at the Pompano for some time, and then a disturbing thought struck him. George, he said, do you expect me to go down in that thing? Why, sure, answered George, giving a final bash at the rudder. What are you worried about? I've taken her out lots of times. She's safe as houses. We won't be going any deeper than 20 feet. There are circumstances, retorted Harry, when I should find a mere 6 feet of water more than adequate. And didn't I mention my claustrophobia? It always comes on badly at this time of year. Nonsense, said George. You'll forget all about it when we're out on the reef. He stood back and surveyed his handiwork, then said with a sigh of satisfaction, Looks okay now. Let's have some breakfast. During the next 30 minutes, Harry learned a good deal about the Pompano. George had designed and built her himself, and her powerful little diesel could drive her at 5 knots when she was fully submerged. Both crew and engine breathed through a snorkel tube, so there was no need to bother about electric motors and an independent air supply. The length of the snorkel limited dives to 25 feet, but in these shallow waters, this was no great handicap. I put a lot of novel ideas into her, said George enthusiastically. Those windows, for instance, look at their size. They'll give you a perfect view, yet they're quite safe. I use the old aqualung principle to keep the air pressure in the Pompano exactly the same as the water pressure outside, so there's no strain on the hull or the ports. And what happens, asked Harry, if you get stuck on the bottom? I open the door and get out, of course. There are a couple of spare aqualungs in the cabin, as well as a life raft with a waterproof radio, so that we can always yell for help if we get in trouble. Don't worry, I've thought of everything. Famous last words, muttered Harry. But he decided that after the ride down from Boston, he undoubtedly had a charmed life. The sea was probably a safer place than US-1 with George at the wheel. He made himself thoroughly familiar with the escape arrangements before they set out, and was fairly happy when he saw how well-designed and constructed the little craft appeared to be. The fact that a lawyer had produced such a neat piece of marine engineering in his spare time was not in the least unusual. Harry had long ago discovered that a considerable number of Americans put quite as much effort into their hobbies as into their professions. They chugged out of the little harbor, keeping to the marked channel until they were well clear of the coast. The sea was calm, and as the shore receded, the water became steadily more and more transparent. They were leaving behind the fog of pulverized coral which clouded the coastal waters, where the waves were incessantly tearing at the land. After 30 minutes, they had come to the reef, visible below them as a kind of patchwork quilt, above which multicolored fish pirouetted to and fro. George closed the hatches, opened the valve of the buoyancy tanks, and said gaily, Here we go. The wrinkled silk veil lifted, crept past the window, distorting all vision for a moment, and then they were through, no longer aliens looking into the world of waters, but denizens of that world themselves. They were floating above a valley carpeted with white sand and surrounded by low hills of coral. The valley itself was barren, but the hills around it were alive with things that grew, things that crawled, and things that swam. Fish, as dazzling as neon signs, wandered lazily among the animals that looked like trees. It seemed not only a breathtakingly lovely, but also a peaceful world. There was no haste, no sign of a struggle for existence. Harry knew very well that this was an illusion, but during all the time they were submerged, he never saw one fish attack another. He mentioned this to George, who commented, Yeah, that's a funny thing about fish. They seem to have definite feeding times. You can see barracuda swimming around, and if the dinner gong hasn't gone, the other fish won't take any notice of them. A ray, looking like some fantastic black butterfly, flapped its way across the sand, balancing itself with its long, whip-like tail. The sensitive feelers of a crayfish waved cautiously from a crack in the coral. The exploring gestures reminded Harry of a soldier testing for snipers with his hat on a stick. There was so much life of so many kinds crammed in this single spot that it would take years of study to recognize it all. The Pompano cruised very slowly along the valley while George gave a running commentary. "I used to do this sort of thing with the Aqualung," he said. "But then I decided how nice it would be to sit in comfort and have an engine to push me around. Then I could stay out all day, take a meal along, use my cameras, and not give a damn if a shark was sneaking up on me. Oh, there goes a tang. Did you ever see such a brilliant blue in your life? Besides, I could show my friends around down here while still being able to talk to them. That's one big handicap with ordinary diving gear. You're deaf and dumb. Have to talk in signs. Look at those angelfish. One day I'm going to fix up a net to catch some of them. See the way they vanish when they're edge on? Another reason why I built the Pompano was so that I could look for wrecks. There are hundreds in this area. It's an absolute graveyard. The Santa Margarita is only about 50 miles from here, in Biscayne Bay. She went down in 1595 with $7 million of bullion aboard. And there's a little matter of $65 million off Long Cay, where 14 galleons sank in 1715. Trouble is, of course, that most of these wrecks have been smashed up and overgrown with coral, so it wouldn't do you a lot of good even if you did locate them. But it's fun to try. By this time, Harry had begun to appreciate his friend's psychology. He could think of few better ways of escaping from a New England law practice. George was a repressed romantic, and not such a repressed one either, now that he came to think of it. They cruised along happily for a couple of hours, keeping in water that was never more than 40 feet deep. Once they grounded on a dazzling stretch of broken coral and took time off for liver-verse sandwiches and glasses of beer. "I drank some ginger beer down here once," said George. "When I came up, the gas inside me expanded, and it was a very odd sort of feeling. Let's try it with champagne some day." Harry was just wondering what to do with the empties when the Pompano seemed to go into eclipse as a dark shadow drifted overhead. Looking up through the observation window, he saw that a ship was moving slowly past 20 feet above their heads. There was no danger of a collision, as they had pulled down their snort for just this reason and were subsisting for the moment on their capital as far as air was concerned. Harry had never seen a ship from underneath, and began to add another novel experience to the many he had acquired today. He was quite proud of the fact that, despite his ignorance of matters nautical, he was just as quick as George at spotting what was wrong with the vessel sailing overhead. Instead of the normal shaft and screw, this ship had a long tunnel running the length of its keel. As it passed above them, the Pompano was rocked by the sudden rush of water. "I'll be damned," said George, grabbing the controls. "That looks like some kind of jet propulsion system. Well, it's about time somebody tried one out. Let's have a look." He pushed up the periscope and discovered that the ship slowly cruising past them was the Valency of New Orleans. "Well, that's a funny name," he said. "What does it mean?" "Well, I would say," answered Harry, "that it means the owner is a chemist. Except for the fact that no chemist would ever make enough money to buy a ship like that." "I'm going to follow her," decided George. "She's only making 5 knots, and I'd like to see how that dingus works." He elevated the snort, got the diesel running, and started in pursuit. After a brief chase, the Pompano drew within 50 feet of the Valency, and Harry felt rather like a submarine commander about to launch a torpedo. They couldn't miss from this distance. In fact, they nearly made a direct hit, for the Valency suddenly slowed to a halt, and before George realized what had happened, he was alongside her. "No signals," he complained, without much logic. A minute later, it was clear that the maneuver was no accident. A lasso dropped neatly over the Pompano's snorkel, and they were efficiently gaffed. There was nothing to do but emerge, rather sheepishly, and make the best of it. Fortunately, their captors were reasonable men and could recognize the truth when they heard it. 15 minutes after coming aboard the Valency, George and Harry were sitting on the bridge while a uniformed steward brought them highballs, and they listened attentively to the theories of Dr. Gilbert Romano. They were still both a little overawed at being in Dr. Romano's presence. It was rather like meeting a live Rockefeller or a reigning Dupont. The doctor was a phenomenon virtually unknown in Europe and unusual even in the United States, the big scientist who had become a bigger businessman. He was now in his late 70s and had just been retired after a considerable tussle from the chairmanship of the vast chemical engineering firm he had founded. It was rather amusing, Harry told us, to notice the subtle social distinctions which differences in wealth can produce even in the most democratic country. By Harry's standards, George was a very rich man. His income was around $100,000 a year, but Dr. Romano was in another price range altogether and had to be treated accordingly with a kind of friendly respect which had nothing to do with obsequiousness. On his side, the doctor was perfectly free and easy. There was nothing about him that gave any impression of wealth, if one ignored such trivia as 150-foot ocean-going yachts. The fact that George was on first-name terms with most of the doctor's business acquaintances helped to break the ice and to establish the purity of their motives. Harry spent a boring half-hour while business deals ranging over half the United States were discussed in terms of what Bill so-and-so did in Pittsburgh, who Joe somebody else ran into at the Bankers Club in Houston, how Clyde Thingamy happened to be playing golf at Augusta while Ike was there. It was a glimpse of a mysterious world where immense power was wielded by men who all seemed to have gone to the same colleges, or who at any rate belonged to the same clubs. Harry soon became aware of the fact that George was not merely paying court to Dr. Romano because that was the polite thing to do. George was too shrewd a lawyer to miss the chance of building up some goodwill and appeared to have forgotten all about the original purpose of their expedition. Harry had to wait for a suitable gap in the conversation before he could raise the subject which really interested him. When it dawned on Dr. Romano that he was talking to another scientist, he promptly abandoned finance, and George was the one who was left out in the cold. The thing that puzzled Harry was why a distinguished chemist should be interested in marine propulsion. Being a man of direct action, he challenged the doctor on this point. For a moment, the scientist appeared a little embarrassed, and Harry was about to apologize for his inquisitiveness, a feat that would have required real effort on his part. But before he could do this, Dr. Romano had excused himself and disappeared into the bridge. He came back 5 minutes later with a rather satisfied expression and continued as if nothing had happened. "A very natural question, Mr. Purvis," he chuckled. "I'd have asked it myself. But do you really expect me to tell you?"
It was just a vague sort of hope," confessed Harry.
"And I'm going to surprise you. Surprise you twice, in fact. I'm going to answer you, and I'm going to show you that I'm not passionately interested in marine propulsion. Those bulges on the bottom of my ship, which you were inspecting with such great interest, do contain the screws, but they also contain a good deal else as well. Let me give you," continued Dr. Romano, now obviously warming up to his subject, "a few elementary statistics about the ocean. We can see a lot of it from here, quite a few square miles. Did you know that every cubic mile of seawater contains 150 million tons of minerals?"
"Frankly, no," said George. "It's an impressive thought."
"It's impressed me for a long time," said the doctor. "Here we go, grubbing about in the earth for our metals and chemicals while every element that exists can be found in seawater. The ocean, in fact, is a kind of universal mine which can never be exhausted. We may plunder the land, but we'll never empty the sea. Men have already started to mine the sea, you know.
Dow Chemical has been taking out bromine for years. Every cubic mile contains about 300,000 tons. More recently, we've started to do something about the 5 million tons of magnesium per cubic mile. But that sort of thing is merely a beginning. The great practical problem is that most of the elements present in seawater are in such low concentrations. The first seven elements make up about 99% of the total, and it's the remaining 1% that contains all the useful metals except magnesium. All my life I've wondered how we could do something about this, and the answer came during the war. I don't know if you're familiar with the techniques used in the atomic energy field to remove minute quantities of isotopes from solutions. Some of those methods are still pretty much under wraps.
Are you talking about ion exchange resins? Hazarded Harry.
Well, something similar. My firm developed several of these techniques on AEC contracts, and I realized at once that they would have wider applications. I put some of my bright young men to work, and they have made what we call a molecular sieve. That's a mighty descriptive expression. In its way, the thing is a sieve, and we can set it to select anything we like. It depends on very advanced wave mechanical theories for its operation, but what it actually does is absurdly simple. We can choose any component of seawater we like, and get the sieve to take it out. With several units working in series, we can take out one element after another. The efficiency is quite high, and the power consumption negligible.
I know, yelped George. You're extracting gold from seawater.
Huh, snorted Dr. Romano in tolerant disgust. I've got better things to do with my time. Too much damn gold around anyhow. I'm after the commercially useful metals, the ones our civilization is going to be desperately short of in another couple of generations. And as a matter of fact, even with my sieve, it wouldn't be worth going after gold. There are only about 50 pounds of the stuff in every cubic mile.
What about uranium? Asked Harry.
Or is that scarcer still? I rather wish you hadn't asked that question, replied Dr. Romano with a cheerfulness that belied the remark. But since you can look it up in any library, there's no harm in telling you that uranium's 200 times more common than gold. About 7 tons in every cubic mile. A figure which is, shall we say, distinctly interesting. So why bother about gold?
Why indeed, echoed George.
To continue, said Dr. Romano, duly continuing, even with a molecular sieve, we've still got the problem of processing enormous volumes of seawater. There are a number of ways one could tackle this. You could build giant pumping stations, for example. But I've always been keen on killing two birds with one stone, and the other day I did a little calculation that gave the most surprising result. I found that every time the Queen Mary crosses the Atlantic, her screws chew up about a tenth of a cubic mile of water. 15 million tons of minerals, in other words. Or, take the case you indiscreetly mentioned, almost a ton of uranium on every Atlantic crossing. Quite a thought, isn't it? So, it seemed to me that all we need to do to create a very useful mobile extraction plant was to put the screws of any vessel inside a tube which would compel the slipstream to pass through one of my sieves. Of course, there's a certain loss of propulsive power, but our experimental unit works very well. We can't go quite as fast as we did, but the farther we cruise, the more money we make from our mining operations. Now, do you think the shipping companies will find that very attractive? But, of course, that's merely incidental. I look forward to the building of floating extraction plants that'll cruise round and round in the ocean until they fill their hoppers with anything you care to name. When that day comes, we'll be able to stop tearing up the land, and all our material shortages will be over. Everything goes back to the sea in the long run anyway. And once we've unlocked that treasure chest, we'll be set for eternity.
For a moment, there was silence on deck, save for the faint clink of ice in the tumblers, while Dr. Romano's guests contemplated this dazzling prospect. Then Harry was struck by a sudden thought. "This is quite one of the most important inventions I've ever heard of," he said. "And that's why I find it rather odd that you should have confided in us so fully. After all, we're perfect strangers, and for all you know, might be spying on you." The old scientist chortled gaily. "Don't worry about that, my boy," he reassured Harry. "I've already been on to Washington and had my friends check up on you." Harry blinked for a minute, then realized how it had been done. He remembered Dr. Romano's brief disappearance and could picture what had happened. There would have been a radio call to Washington. Some senator would have got onto the embassy. The Ministry of Supply representative would have done his bit. And in 5 minutes, the doctor would have got the answer he wanted. Yes, Americans were very efficient, those who could afford to be. It was about this time that Harry became aware of the fact that they were no longer alone. A much larger and more impressive yacht than the Valency was heading towards them, and in a few minutes he was able to read the name Sea Spray. Such a name, he thought, was more appropriate to billowing sails than throbbing diesels, but there was no doubt that the spray was a very pretty creature indeed. He could understand the looks of undisguised covetousness that both George and Dr. Romano now plainly bore. The sea was so calm that the two yachts were able to come alongside each other, and as soon as they had made contact, a sunburned, energetic man in the late 40s vaulted over onto the deck of the Valency. He strode up to Dr. Romano, shook his hand vigorously, said, "Well, you old rascal, what are you up to?" and then looked inquiringly at the rest of the company. The doctor carried out the introductions. It seemed that they had been boarded by Professor Scott Mackenzie, who had been sailing his yacht down from Key Largo. "Oh, no," cried Harry to himself. "This is too much. One millionaire scientist per day is all I can stand." But there was no getting away from it. True, Mackenzie was very seldom seen in the academic cloisters, but he was a genuine professor nonetheless, holding the chair of geophysics at some Texas college. 90% of his time, however, he spent working for the big oil companies and running a consulting firm of his own. It rather looked as if he had made his torsion balances and seismographs pay quite well for themselves. In fact, though he was a much younger man than Dr. Romano, he had even more money owing to being in a more rapidly expanding industry. Harry gathered that the peculiar tax laws of the sovereign state of Texas also had something to do with it. It seemed an unlikely coincidence that these two scientific tycoons should have met by chance, and Harry waited to see what skullduggery was afoot. For a while, the conversation was confined to generalities, but it was obvious that Professor Mackenzie was extremely inquisitive about the doctor's other two guests. Not long after they'd been introduced, he made some excuse to hop back to his own ship, and Harry moaned inwardly. If the embassy got two separate inquiries about him in the space of half an hour, they'd wonder what he'd been up to. It might even make the FBI suspicious. And then how would he get those promised 24 pairs of nylons out of the country? He found it quite fascinating to study the relation between the two scientists. They were like a couple of fighting cocks circling for position. Romano treated the young man with a downright rudeness which, Harry suspected, concealed a grudging admiration. It was clear that Dr. Romano was an almost fanatical conservationist, and regarded the activities of Mackenzie and his employers with the greatest disapproval. "You're a gang of robbers," he said once. "You're seeing how quickly you can loot this planet of its resources, and you don't give a damn about the next generation." "And what," answered Mackenzie, not very originally, "has the next generation ever done for us?" The sparring continued for the best part of an hour, and much of what went on was completely over Harry's head. He wondered why he and George were being allowed to sit in on all this,
and after a while he began to appreciate Dr. Romano's technique. He was an opportunist of genius. He was glad to keep them around, now that they had turned up, just to worry Professor Mackenzie and make him wonder what other deals were afoot. He let the molecular sieve leak out bit by bit, as if it wasn't really important, and he was only mentioning it in passing. Professor Mackenzie, however, latched onto it at once, and the more evasive Romano became, the more insistent was his adversary. It was obvious that he was being deliberately coy, and that though Professor Mackenzie knew this perfectly well, he couldn't help playing the older scientist's game. Dr. Romano had been discussing the device in a peculiarly oblique fashion, as if it were a future project rather than an existing fact. He outlined its staggering possibilities and explained how it would make all existing forms of mining obsolete, besides removing forever the danger of world metal shortages.
"Oh, if it's so good," exclaimed Mackenzie presently, "why haven't you made the thing?" "What do you think I'm doing out here in the Gulf Stream?" retorted the doctor. "Take a look at this."
He opened a locker beneath the sonar set and pulled out a small metal bar which he tossed to Mackenzie. It looked like lead and was obviously extremely heavy. The professor hefted it in his hand and said at once,
"Uranium? Do you mean to say..." "Yes, every gram. And there's plenty more where that came from."
He turned to Harry's friend and said,
"George, what about taking the professor down in your submarine to have a look at the works? He won't see much, but it'll show him we're in business."
Mackenzie was still so thoughtful that he took a little thing like a private submarine in his stride. He returned to the surface 15 minutes later, having seen just enough to whet his appetite.
"The first thing I want to know," he said to Romano, "is why you're showing this to me. It's about the biggest thing that ever happened. Why isn't your own firm handling it?"
Romano gave a little snort of disgust.
"You know I've had a row with the board," he said. "Anyway, that lot of old deadbeats couldn't handle anything as big as this. I hate to admit it, but you Texas pirates are the boys for the job."
"This is a private venture of yours?"
"Yes. The company knows nothing about it, and I've sunk $500,000 of my own money into it. It's been a kind of hobby of mine. I felt someone had to undo the damage that was going on, the rape of the continents by people like..."
"All right, we've heard that before. Yet you propose giving it to us?"
"Who said anything about giving?"
There was a pregnant silence. Then Mackenzie said cautiously,
"Of course, there's no need to tell you that we'll be interested, very interested. If you'll let us have the figures on efficiency, extraction rates, and all the other relevant statistics, and no need to tell us the actual technical details if you don't want to, then we'll be able to talk business. I can't really speak for my associates, but I'm sure that they can raise enough cover to make any deal."
"Scott,"
said Romano, and his voice now held a note of tiredness that for the first time reflected his age.
"I'm not interested in doing a deal with your partners. I haven't time to haggle with the boys in the front room and their lawyers and their lawyers' lawyers. 50 years I've been doing that sort of thing, and believe me, I'm tired. This is my development. It was done with my money, and all the equipment is in my ship. I want to do a personal deal direct with you. You can handle it from then on."
Mackenzie blinked.
"I couldn't swing anything as big as this," he protested. "Sure, I appreciate the offer, but if this does what you say, it's worth billions. I'm just a poor but honest millionaire. Money I'm no longer interested in. What would I do with it at my time of life? No, Scott, there's just one thing I want now. And I want it right away, this minute. Give me the sea spray, and you can have my process."
"You're crazy. Why, even with inflation, you could build the spray for inside a million, and your process must be worth..."
I'm not arguing, Scott. What you say is true. But I'm an old man in a hurry. And it would take me a year to get a ship like yours built. I've wanted her ever since you showed her to me back in Miami. My proposal is that you take over the Valency with all her lab equipment and records. It'll only take an hour to swap our personal effects. We've a lawyer here who can make it legal. And then I'm heading out into the Caribbean, down through the islands and across the Pacific. You've got it all worked out, said Mackenzie in awed wonder. Yes, you can take it or leave it. I never heard of such a crazy deal in my life, said Mackenzie somewhat petulantly. Well, of course I'll take it. I know a stubborn old mule when I see one. The next hour was one of frantic activity. Sweating crew members rushed back and forth with suitcases and bundles, while Dr. Romano sat happily in the midst of the turmoil he had created, a blissful smile upon his wrinkled old face. George and Professor Mackenzie went into a legal huddle and emerged with a document which Dr. Romano signed with hardly a glance. Unexpected things began to emerge from the sea spray, such as a beautiful mutation mink and a beautiful non-mutation blonde.
Hello, Sylvia, said Dr. Romano politely. I'm afraid you'll find the quarters here a little more cramped. The professor never mentioned you were aboard. Never mind. We won't mention it either. Not actually in the contract, but a gentleman's agreement, shall we say. It'd be such a pity to upset Mrs. Mackenzie.
I don't know what you mean, pouted Sylvia. Someone has to do all the professor's typing.
And you do it damn badly, my dear, said Mackenzie, assisting her over the rail with true southern gallantry. Harry couldn't help admiring his composure in such an embarrassing situation. He was by no means sure that he would have managed as well. But he wished he had the opportunity to find out. At last, the chaos subsided. The stream of boxes and bundles subsided to a trickle. Dr. Romano shook hands with everybody, thanked George and Harry for their assistance, strode to the bridge of the sea spray, and 10 minutes later was halfway to the horizon. Harry was wondering if it wasn't about time for them to take their departure as well, but they had never got round to explaining to Professor Mackenzie what they were doing here in the first place, when the radio telephone started calling. Dr. Romano was on the line.
Forgotten his toothbrush, I suppose, said George.
It was not quite as trivial as that. Fortunately, the loudspeaker was switched on. Eavesdropping was practically forced upon them, and required none of the effort that makes it so embarrassing to a gentleman.
Look here, Scott, said Dr. Romano. I think I owe you some sort of explanation.
If you chip me, I'll have you for every cent.
Oh, it's not like that. But I did rather pressurize you, though everything I said was perfectly true. Don't get too annoyed with me. You've got a bargain. It'll be a long time, though, before it makes you any money, and you'll have to sink a few millions of your own into it first. You see, the efficiency has to be increased by about 3 orders of magnitude before it'll be a commercial proposition. That bar of uranium cost me $2,000. Now, don't blow your top. It can be done. I'm certain of that. Dr. Kendall is the man to get. He did all the basic work. Hire him away from my people, however much it costs you. You're a stubborn cuss, and I know you'll finish the job now it's in your hands. That's why I wanted you to have it. Poetic justice, too. You'll be able to repay some of the damage you've done to the land. Too bad it'll make you a billionaire, but that can't be helped. But wait a minute, don't cut in on me. I'd have finished the job myself if I'd had the time. But it'll take at least 3 more years. And the doctors say I've only got 6 months. I wasn't kidding when I said I was in a hurry. I'm glad I clinched the deal without having to tell you that. But believe me, I'd have used it as a weapon if I'd had to. Just one more thing. When you do get the process working, name it after me, will you? That's all. It's no use calling me back. I won't answer. And I know you can't catch me. Professor Mackenzie didn't turn a hair. I thought it was something like that, he said to no one in particular. Then he sat down, produced an elaborate pocket slide rule, and became oblivious to the world. He scarcely looked up when George and Harry, feeling very much outclassed, made their polite departure and silently snorkeled away. Like so many things that happen these days, concluded Harry Purvis, I still don't know the final outcome of this meeting. I rather imagine that Professor Mackenzie has run into some snags, or we'd have heard rumors about the process by now. But I've not the slightest doubt that sooner or later it'll be perfected. So, get ready to sell your mining shares. As for Dr. Romano, he wasn't kidding, though his doctors were a little out in their estimates. It lasted a full year, and I guess the sea spray helped a lot. And they buried him in mid-Pacific. And it's just occurred to me that the old boy would have appreciated that. I told you what a fanatical conservationist he was, and it's a piquant thought that even now some of his atoms may be going through his own molecular sieve. I notice some incredulous looks, but it's a fact. If you took a tumbler of water, poured it into the ocean, mixed well, and then filled the glass from the sea, there'd still be some scores of molecules of water from the original sample in the tumbler. So, he gave a gruesome little chuckle, it's only a matter of time before not only Dr. Romano, but all of us, make some contribution to the sieve. And with that thought, gentlemen, I bid you all a very pleasant good night.